Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were speaking about, which was this idea, or actually this answer to our question on why we have a lack of attention when it comes to our ubudiyah. Now, we had said that we feel like we are distracted by a million different things, right as we say the Takbiratul Ahram, this Allahu Akbar, where we state that we have started our salah. Or, for example, in any of our other formal ubudiyas. Now, in case you're listening, in the next episode, we are going to talk about the difference between formal and informal ubudiyah. So make sure to join us on that program. Still, we were talking about this lack of attention, and one of the things, excuse me, that we said which distracts us in our ubudiyah is this idea that throughout the day we are engrossed in the material aspect of the world. We are totally absorbed in the material aspect of the world. You know, for example, we are in this chain of consumerism. We want to buy more. We want to, you know, eat more, we want to drink more, we want more entertainment, we want more of this and more of that, and glamour and fame and cartoons and televisions and TV serials and movies, and wow, even talking about it makes one overwhelmed. And when you have so much that is engrossing and absorbing your powers and your attention, then how can we expect to all of a sudden make a transition, forget about all these things, and pay attention in our salah, which, as we said, is one of the, if not the pillar of ubudiyah. So what happens is we are engrossed in the materialistic aspect of the dunya, money, wealth, power, fame, materialistic things, consumerism, buy more, right? Then all of a sudden it's Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, qad qamat as-salah. And when we stand up for the prayers, we are still engrossed in that materialistic aspect. And so all of our thoughts are where? In the materialistic aspect. And by the time we're done, because how long is the salah? How long is the recitation of the Quran? How long is the recitation of the du'as? It's just a few minutes. And so in that few minutes, we are still feeling the after effects of our complete engrossment and absorption and being in love with the materialistic world, so that by the time we say, As-salamu alayka ayyuhan nabiyyu wa rahmatullah, oh, the prayer is done and we didn't pay any attention. So if we want to increase our attention in our ubudiyah, we're going to have to cut ourselves off and make a transition towards this salah before we get into the salah.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
As we stated, the verse of the Holy Quran says, the final accomplishment will be the spread of justice on the face of the earth and the establishment of the just government of the Imam of our time. This is the final victory that God has promised will happen. But for us, if we're going to be part of it or not, if we're going to be on the right side or not, this is very important. We can test ourselves on this. Are we like the people who were too attached to this to leave it for Ali ibn Abi Talib? Leave it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Or are we going to be the ones that are not going to be like that? We have to try to detach ourselves from the luxury, the glamour of this dunya that is all over the place here in the West. That the children of the dunya are working hard together. We have to seriously, brothers and sisters, work on this, because it's definitely not easy. It's definitely not easy. The story of Karbala is a very important story to learn from. This is a real story, brothers and sisters, that the daughters of Imam Hussein have narrated for us. One of the enemies of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein is pulling on the clothes of the daughter of Imam al-Hussein to take it, and he's crying. She tells him, "Why are you crying?" He says, "Because I realize I'm taking this from the daughter of the grandson of the Holy Prophet." She tells him, "Well, if you understand that, then stop." He says, "I'm afraid if I don't take it, somebody else is going to come and take it." This is how terrible hubbud dunya is going to become.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemn the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akleh was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and the disrespectful behavior.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening, which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shireen was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Months after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, confessed that Washington was mainly to blame for the collapse of the former Afghan government and national security and defense forces. The report by SIGAR reveals that Afghan forces' morale were destroyed after then-U.S. President Donald Trump reached a deal with the Taliban in 2020, and President Joe Biden affirmed the U.S. withdrawal in 2021.
In my opinion, the Doha deal paved the way for the U.S.-led foreign forces' withdrawal from Afghanistan. It also gave the Taliban forces the belief that they can take over Afghanistan easily. In fact, the Doha deal and the U.S. withdrawal both were great achievements for the Taliban and Afghanistan.
Former Afghan generals and experts also told the agency that most American support to Afghan forces was stopped or limited, while the Taliban had intensified attacks.
I agree with the SIGAR report. The former Afghan Republic government was defeated when the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban. After the Doha deal, the U.S. stopped its major logistic support, including fuel, rockets, arms, and air support to Afghan forces. It continued until the Afghan army completely ran out of equipment.
SIGAR notes that in essence, U.S. and Afghan efforts to cultivate an effective and sustainable security assistance sector were likely to fail from the beginning. Afghan experts also say that the U.S. never meant to build a nation or a state in the country, and all Western-backed armies are doomed to failure.
The former Afghan government was an example of American state-building. They invaded our country, formed their own government, and finally demolished it. They never meant to boost the state-nation process. The Americans appointed their own men to the Afghan government, while they were not representing Afghan people. In addition, the U.S. intentionally established a corrupt and dependent army in Afghanistan.
The Taliban took over Afghanistan in August 2021 as the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan and the former Western-backed government collapsed. Afghans are angry with the U.S. for pushing Afghanistan into a dire situation. People here believe Washington not only betrayed Afghans but also continues to harm them with sanctions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, a recent order by the authorities is giving sleepless nights to many business owners and shopkeepers. Business owners, big and small, are spending hundreds of dollars each to install security cameras, a mandatory move ordered by the authorities. The official order says the scheme will deter criminals, antisocial and anti-national elements. The order also outlines the minimum standards for camera resolution, infrared capability and range. The government's order has been highly criticized by business owners. They describe the move as a callous approach towards war-weary Kashmir's fractured business establishments, which were deeply dented after India cancelled Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019.
Everybody knows the quantum of the business, it's almost 80% down. It was their duty to install the CC camera. Why to tell to the business you install the CC TV cameras? You see, the 80% of the business company, they cannot afford to install this CCTV camera. So I think they should review this decision and they should look into this.
Muzaffar Jan, a shop owner in the heart of Srinagar's busiest market, Lal Chowk, says it has been days since he has seen a customer at his store. However, to follow the police instructions, he was forced to pull out the money he had saved for running his household.
I waited for around a week to see whether others would install cameras. Later, I was forced because of continuous announcements and strict orders. I installed the camera. It took me around $1,000, and not everyone can afford this cost. In Kashmir, there are frequent power cuts, and to keep the camera plugged in, I had to install an uninterrupted power supply inverter. Many of us can't manage 2 meals a day. How can we afford these cameras?
The order further instructs that the cameras installed at the business owner's expense must always stay on. The system should record and store footage for 30 days and must be produced on demand of police and other law enforcement agencies without any court order. And failure to abide by the order will result in a fine or month-long imprisonment. The level of surveillance in Kashmir is increasing day by day. Authorities argue that the measure will help them protect people's lives. But Kashmiris are calling the move as a worrying development and see it as a threat to their human rights, privacy and dignity. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Much of Mariupol may lie in ruins, but the city is already coming back to life after months of fierce fighting. A market is open, selling all essential goods, and humanitarian aid is being distributed by organizations associated with the Russian government.
These days, the situation is more or less stabilized. People are fed. There are more problems with water, electricity and gas in some parts, and there are still problems with basic domestic needs.
Amongst the ruins, I came across a gathering who are waiting for a drop-off of humanitarian supplies.
During the fighting, I was at home. When there were battles, the house was shaking. I stood with my back to the wall and I was shaking with the wall. When I think of it, I still shiver. There was nothing good about the fighting. We don't want anything except peace and quiet now.
The population of Mariupol before the war was about 450,000. Now, it's hard to estimate, but we think around a third of those people still remain, either stayed during the battle or stayed nearby the city in camps and have now returned. Over the next days, weeks, months, years, we can expect many thousands of people to return here to Mariupol. But who will be those people? Before the conflict began, the city was very mixed between pro-Russian, Russian-speaking people and more Ukrainian nationalist, pro-Ukrainian people. Now that it's under Russian control, as long as it stays under Russian control, we can expect many of the Russian people to come back. But for the Ukrainians, they may well stay away, which means that the ethnic diversity in the city, the ethnic makeup of the city, will change.
It is not yet time to be happy about anything. But there are certain expectations that Russia is a rich country and its politics are more independent, and we hope things will improve.
How do you feel living under Russian rule now rather than Ukrainian?
You see, we cannot say anything yet. We don't understand anything yet. We only want it to be peaceful and quiet. That's what people want here. What else can we say?
Like many people I speak to in areas recently taken over by Russia, she is scared to answer such questions. She may be more pro-Ukrainian, or she might be worried that Russia might not be in control of Mariupol for long. Down by the port area, I found the incongruous sight of fishermen, seemingly oblivious to the fact that war was still raging across the country.
Of course I'm happy. Of course. Truth to tell, we've been waiting for it for a long time. Of course, yes, I'm happy to be under Russian control now, because we have become free. Well, we were free before, but not in this way. The attitude changed. People have a different attitude to each other now. Earlier, we were afraid to say things and speak our minds. Yes, I could get into trouble if I criticized the Ukrainian government.
This is commonly heard amongst Russian speakers here, that they have been marginalized and persecuted by the increasingly nationalist Ukrainian government. This is the reason the East rose up 8 years ago, and why many here welcome the Russians. Unless Ukraine takes back Mariupol,
It will now likely be populated predominantly by an ethnic Russian population. Whatever the fate of this city, it will never be the same again. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The controversial idea of creating an EU army has now come to pass in all but name. The European Commission confirmed on Wednesday the bloc's 27 nations have agreed to jointly spend €200 billion on military hardware over the next few years.
Joint procurement is better operationally for our armed forces, because this strengthens the interoperability between the armed forces.
Citizens are struggling to survive, mainly due to the economic fallout from the conflict in Ukraine. But it appears EU authorities have other priorities.
We need modern air defences. We need drones. We need air-to-air refuelling capabilities. We need tanks and armoured vehicles. We need coastal defence.
Anti-war demonstrators in Brussels say the extra billions being spent on NATO and the EU army cannot be justified.
Just those people are saying that we have to secure ourselves. Against who? Against what? Against, I don't know.
We want Belgium out of NATO, and we want NATO out of Belgium.
The European Commission insists the EU's military spending plan will complement the work of NATO, not erode it. But military experts are saying that is inevitable, and they say the project has already seriously undermined NATO's credibility. The Commission has also just announced an additional €9 billion for the Ukrainian government.
Since the beginning of Russia's aggression on 24th of February, the EU has provided €4.1 billion to help Ukraine.
Hard-pressed EU taxpayers might wonder how the money will be spent. Last September, the bloc's financial watchdog revealed how corruption is rife in Ukraine at every level, from the government to the judiciary. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Hamas government media office has held a big ceremony in Gaza to pay tribute to fallen Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Abu Akleh was killed after being shot in the head while covering Israeli army raids in the northern occupied West Bank last week. Palestinian journalists, academics, and senior Palestinian officials attended the ceremony. Palestinian officials accused Israeli regime forces of deliberately killing Shireen Abu Akleh.
Shireen was killed in cold blood, like many Palestinian journalists. Israeli forces have killed some 50 Palestinian journalists during the last 22 years. We demand that Israeli leaders be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian journalists.
Abu Akleh was wearing a press vest that identified her as a member of the press when she was shot by Israeli snipers. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, protective gear that clearly indicates individuals are journalists should grant them extra protection, not make them targets.
We demand, and I think the international community should all demand justice for Shireen Abu Akleh. What is happening from the Israeli occupation, the constant targeting of journalists, is just a systematic, ongoing, punitive reaction that keeps on going. It has been going on for so long, and it still is continuing.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye. Under the Geneva Conventions, journalists, like other civilians, enjoy protection amid armed conflicts.
I believe that, you know, killing Shireen Abu Akleh was not the first crime that the Israeli occupation has committed, and it won't be the last one. I believe that as long as there is a military occupation of the Palestinian territories, these crimes won't stop, especially against Palestinian journalists.
While covering Israeli attacks, Palestinian journalists work hard to avoid being part of the story themselves.
Observers say that Shireen Abu Akleh's killing is another example of the Israeli regime's brutality against the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are illegal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akla. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shireen is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that exposed the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Life is complicated. I don't think this fact is hidden or doubted by anyone that life is pretty darn complicated. Mostly because of other people, we have trouble understanding other people. We can't read one another's minds. We all come from different backgrounds and cultures and traumas and environments. And it's hard for us to be able to read each other. And it's hard for us to read ourselves, really, to be honest. 85% of the problems and complications I deal personally in my life is because I don't know what the heck is going on with me. So trying to decipher that is a whole journey of its own. And then determining what our destination and purpose is and what's our objective and goal and what are we doing here and trying to find meaning in all this, all of that just adds to the complication and the difficultness of life. But whether you're a religious person or not, it's also a proven fact that through this journey, one of the elements which is of the utmost importance in helping us overcome these hardships and difficulties is, ironically enough, a good companion, being in the company of another person. What do I mean by that? Why is it so important? What are its effects and impacts on our lives? What are the dimensions of this relationship? All of that and much more in this short, cute little anecdote we will listen to together, and we're going to be right back to the point I'm trying to make. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear friends, we have a nice story for this part. Thank you very much for listening to Lantern. The two pots. Two pots, one of the brass and the other of clay, stood together on the hearthstone. One day the brass pot proposed to the earthen pot that they go out into the world together, but the earthen pot excused himself, saying that it would be wiser for him to stay in the corner by the fire. "It would take so little to break me," he said. "You know how fragile I am. The least shock is sure to shatter me." "Don't let that keep you at home," urged the brass pot. "I shall take very good care of you. If you should happen to meet anything hard, I will step between and save you." So the earthen pot at last consented, and the two set out side by side, jolting along on three stubby legs, first to this side, then to that, and bumping into each other at every step. The earthen pot could not survive that sort of companionship very long. They had not gone 10 paces before the earthen pot cracked, and at the next jolt he flew into 1,000 pieces, equals make the best friends.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at a story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So, whether you're the brass or the clay pot in life, it's really important. Companionship and finding a suitable companion is one of the most important things we can do. Some might even say it's the most important thing in trying to, you know, make it through life, through this journey, and to reach that destination. I don't know about you guys, but this story sort of reminded me of the story of Prophet Musa, ala nabiyyina wa alayhi salam, and Prophet Khidr, which has been stated in Surah Al-Kahf. It's a very peculiar story, very peculiar story that we need to study thoroughly because it's so cryptic and some parts of it are just so ambiguous. But it also alludes to the whole concept of finding good companions in our lives. In order to get anything done, really, because we human beings, whether it's a good thing or not, for those of us i.e. myself, who suffer from crippling social anxiety. It's not necessarily a very comfortable thing, but nonetheless, we human beings are social creatures, right? We critically depend on community to survive. It's been like this since forever. And we need other people to rely on in terms of having our needs met, whether it's material needs, economical needs, whether it's for protection and support, whether it's for emotional, biological, psychological, physical support. It's one of those things that if we lack in our lives, we literally fall apart. And that is one of the reasons why the modern generation, the modern folk, is suffering from so much depression, because we've isolated ourselves so much and we're living such island lives. We are so engulfed and obsessed in individualism, and we are so estranged from one another. And we have lost touch and we have forgotten the ethics and the etiquettes of coexistence. And it's so sad. It's really, really so very sad. More of that later. The point is, through the story of Prophet Musa and Prophet Khidr alayhi salam, we learn that on one hand, for us to acquire any degree of growth, it's important for us to associate ourselves with those who are maybe a couple of notches higher than us, which is the case with Prophet Musa and Prophet Khidr alayhi salam, which could have been the case for the clay pot and the brass pot as well. It is only through exposing ourselves to diverse mindsets and different worldviews can we develop and can we progress and can we grow, right? Obviously, if we only associate with people who are at our exact level, there's no challenge. There's no exchange of opinion and knowledge in a way that can contribute to either of our growths. But on the other hand, there has to be some similarities as well. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.
In the limelight. The coming mass migration of flood-prone areas will have huge social and economic costs, but the US government doesn't have an adequate plan. We now present you an article written by Max Ufberg. The piece is titled, It's Happening Now: How Rising Sea Levels Are Causing a U.S. Migration Crisis. Sea levels have risen about 9 inches since 1880, with one-third of that gain from the last 25 years alone. Every year, a flurry of reports are published warning of the risk to towns and cities along the coastal areas of the United States. It's one thing to hear about a looming disaster, it's another to see the cataclysm play out in real time. That's what's happening in Tahola, a village on Washington's coast that acts as the capital for the Quinault Indian Nation, a tribe of about 3,600 members. In Tahola, climate change caused sea level rise has brought to the community a fast receding shoreline, and with it, a heightened threat of flooding. According to Quinault estimates, the ocean level could increase by 2.6 feet by 2100, pushing storm surges higher and bringing waves closer to town. On an overcast February morning, Raleigh Ralston, the 62-year-old treasurer of the Quinault Nation, drove his silver Ford SUV down a network of Tahola's unmarked gravel roads, telling me about what this place used to look like before climate change permanently reconfigured the landscape. Parked on a rock face overlooking the Pacific Ocean, he nodded towards a moss-covered boulder towering out of the water. As a kid in the 1960s, Larry Ralston said, he was able to trek by foot to the rock, and now he reckons the water is 30 feet deep. Back then, the ocean didn't seem like a menace, at least not an existential one. But that's no longer the case. Some 660 Tahola residents who border the ocean now find themselves living in an increasingly dangerous flood zone. The only solution is for everyone and everything in the village to move uphill. Larry Ralston said, "We can see firsthand what's happening. There is no denying it. Tahola signals what's to come for coastal communities across the country." Already about 15 million American homes are at risk of flooding, and the threat is only going to get worse. A report released in February by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, projected that sea level along the U.S. coastline would rise by 10 to 12 inches on average in the next 30 years. An uptick that would make damaging flooding occur 10 times more often than it does today. William Sweet, an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Ocean Service and the country's top scientist studying sea level rise, said, "It's important to understand in these communities that sea level rise is happening now. Its impacts are happening now, and those impacts will grow worse in the next 30 years. Mining nuisance flooding will be replaced by flooding that's more damaging to economies and to infrastructure. That future could very well touch off a mass migration of people away from coastline and flood zones." Research published in 2020 in the journal PLOS ONE estimated that sea level rise could cause over 13 million Americans to relocate inland by 2100. An outcome with huge economic, social and political consequences. Yet, even with the deluge of warnings, there is no centralized lifeline available to coastal communities in the United States. There are a number of federal programs designed to give assistance to such areas through government bodies like the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But those pots of money are far from adequate to tackle a problem of this scale. Some local governments have chosen to offer, and in a few cases mandate, buyouts to homeowners in vulnerable areas. who wind up dispersing. Others would prefer to keep the neighborhood intact, in Tahola's case, by moving the whole village. In 2017, the Quinault Tribal Council adopted the Tahola Village Relocation Master Plan, which would move the lower enclave of the village about a half a mile uphill by 2030, where a new 200-acre development would offer flood-free land for over 300 housing units, a police station, a courthouse, a K-12 school and a museum, among other buildings. The initiative makes the Quinault among the first in the United States, alongside communities in Louisiana and Alaska, among others, to voluntarily opt for a strategy of managed retreat away from impending climate threats. To date, the council has been able to build a new administrative complex, a so-called Generations Building, to house Head Start and senior programs, and approximately 150 homes, construction that is owed to a combination of U.S. Department of Agriculture grants, housing and urban development money, and the tribe's own funds. To pay for the rest, Larry Ralston estimates they'll need an additional $200 million, a daunting sum, especially considering the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was signed into law by President Biden last year, provided just $130 million to support relocation efforts for the 574 federally recognized tribes across the United States. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, there are roughly 5.7 million American Indians and Alaska Natives in the United States, many of whom are on the front lines of climate change. A multi-year study published last year in the journal Science found that indigenous nations in the United States not only lost 99% of their historical land, but what relatively little they were eventually allotted are often more exposed to climate change hazards than their historical lands. The Quinault Nation settled permanently on their 189,621-acre reservation, much of it conifer forest and unsuitable to farming, in the 19th century, after a long and at times contentious negotiation with the Washington government and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Though the allotted land was still a far cry from what was lost, the ocean provided a natural icebox for sockeye salmon, known as blueback among the Quinault peoples, a unique fish that is central to the Quinault identity, and is under threat due in part to ocean acidification and warmer waters. Larry Ralston said, as his SUV ambled past a large illustrated cutout of the salmon affixed to a lamppost, "There's a parity between the Quinault people and the blueback. We try to save our blueback so we can save ourselves." Just 2 weeks later and 2,400 some miles away from Tahola, I was in the Allen Field subdivision of Houston, Texas, talking with Dolores Mendoza, a 35-year-old mother of three. She is trying to figure out how to convince people in the neighborhood, many of whom are relatives, that the country's effort to remove them from their homes shouldn't be ignored. Tahola and Harris County are a study in contrast. The former, a cash-strapped program that, if successful, would keep a neighborhood intact, and the latter, a messy but better-funded effort that will ultimately move people out of high-risk zones but tear a community apart. I met Dolores Mendoza, who works as a credit controller at an inspection agency on a chilly afternoon at her former home, a three-bedroom house that's just a stone's throw from the Greens Bayou watershed. Harris County bought the place in December, paying Mendoza a total of $300,000 for the property, $70,000 for the house, and $230,000 to relocate. The sale was a coup for her, given that she paid $62,000 to buy the 1,200-square-feet house in 2010. She has since moved to Kingwood, a wealthier neighborhood about 15 miles away. That's not to say that Dolores Mendoza was keen on leaving. She grew up in Allenfield and, by her count, still has family living in 13 different nearby houses. She said, "I wanted this community. It's not pretty to look at, but my family's here. It's only a matter of time before that's no longer the case." As we walk through the beige-coloured house, which had been ransacked and vandalised in the 2 months since its sale, Mendoza recalls how the place used to look when she and her three children lived there. Harris County is a sprawling region of 4.7 million people, about half of whom live in Houston, Texas. Much like Tahola, it is caught in climate change's crosshairs. Hurricanes are becoming more common in the area, bringing with them enough rainwater to flood the state's bayou systems. Hurricane Harvey, which hit Houston in 2017 and took the lives of at least 88 individuals in Texas, was the third 500-year flood within the last 3 years. Worse yet, the Texas coastline has sunk about 2 feet within the last century, due in part to excessive groundwater pumping, making the state more vulnerable to flooding. But Harris County also bears a different distinction. It is the national leader in federally funded home buyouts, responsible for some 2,500 acquisitions, on top of 1,000 homes purchased by the Harris County Flood Control District with local funds. Since the 1980s, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, has supported over 43,000 property buyouts in the United States. That is well short of the 3.63 million people in the country who are likely to encounter flooding every year. Cesafe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.